In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find. In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 4545, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew, nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 5555, your arms are hanging limp at your sides. Your legs got nothing to do, some machine doing that for you. In the year 6565, ain't gonna need no husband, won't need no wife. You pick your son, pick your daughter too, from the bottom of a long glass tube. Whoa, whoa. In the year 7510, if God's a-coming, he ought to make it by then. Maybe he'll look around himself and say, guess it's time for the judgment day. In the year 8510, God is gonna shake his mighty head. He'll either say, I'm pleased where man has been, or tear it down and start again. Oh, oh. In the year 9595, I'm kinda wondering if man is gonna be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing. Whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years. Man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We've got in Studio B, Tavis Smiley with Andrew Balin, and they're talking about his adventures in China, in Shanghai exactly, and his views of Chinese culture and race.
Why this place? Why China?
It does seem like a paradox.
Yeah, it does.
But in my mind, when I looked at China, I found that bold sense, that the sense that Chinese, in every way, we're saying, look, we are who we are, and we are not going to take this Eurocentric view of the world, this Eurocentric paradigm, and make it our canon. We just won't do it. And that intrigued me. That on top of the fact that it was just so far away, and it seemed to be, at that point, 2001, 2002, sort of moving towards this watershed moment, which I think it's now reached.
How did your dad feel about you dropping out of law school?
I think that my father comes from 1950s, 60s New York. He's an immigrant himself. He came to the States in 1957 from Jamaica. Mm-hmm. He understands success as bootstrap work ethic. You've got this opportunity. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity. He was on welfare, I think, during medical school. Went to Cornell Medical School, finished. And what he was saying is, son, I have given you the best of everything. What I expect of you now is to ensure that you've learned a trade, that you are self-sufficient, and that you can make sure that continues for posterity. But he's my hero, and he was livid. I think he was also disappointed, I think deeply hurt.
Sure.
Because, you know, I think on some level he was saying, what did I do wrong? And the fact of the matter is he hadn't done anything wrong.
How did you choose China?
It was literally me saying, where is it that looks like it has been relatively, in its modern iteration, mm-hmm. untouched mm-hmm. by Western paradigms and Western expectations about me, people of my hue,
right.
and what we can and cannot do. That and the fact that at that point, I think hip-hop to me was, it is my release. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking to myself, I know it's in Japan, I know it's in Korea, but our music probably hasn't really touched China yet. And I used to just dream to myself before I was going, I wonder if they feel the same way when they hear Biggie. I wonder if they feel the same way when they hear Common, when they hear Jill Scott. And I wanted to share that. On some, I didn't realize what medium I would use, but that was it.
So when you got here and you arrived in China, how were you treated initially?
I should first say that I think that everything that I experienced in America prepared me for this. Uh-huh. I mean, growing up sort of middle class in the States, I felt like that fish out of water from the very beginning. Uh-huh. You know, I was raised in a neighborhood that was primarily Jewish, white, very middle class. And I always had that sort of, that internal chip. You know, I'm different. Uh-huh. And so when I came to China, what turned itself a bit was it was you're different, but you're different in an exciting way. I mean, when I was shooting a TV show, people would come up and say, you know, can I rub it off? Can I rub it off? And I'm like, no, you can't. But it excited me, and it gave me an opportunity to, at every moment, let another human being, a Chinese human being, know that our humanity is fully intact. Never mind what you see piped in here via Hollywood and who we are once you get right down to it. Is somebody that you can relate to and share with on a very full and deep level. So it excited me, mm-hmm. honestly.
I've traveled to a number of places around the world, and I've been amazed at the expectations, the impressions, the view that people in these various places had of me the moment I arrived, in large part, to your earlier point, because of Hollywood.
Yes.
So there are certain images, and you know where I'm going with this, not so nice, not so kind, not so charitable or generous ideas and impressions that they had about a guy who looks like me. Indeed. Because of Hollywood. You didn't experience any of that when you first got in?
I experienced that all the time.
Yeah.
And I was just ready for it.
Right.
I mean, to me, the expectation was, this is what they've gotten. And what I found is that sense of that minor sense of revulsion in China, which has been given to them, foisted upon them by the images they're receiving from Hollywood, mm-hmm. Is very, very, very thin. And once you crack that initial surface, there is a depth of welcome and humanity that you receive in China. And what I always found was that it was almost Pavlovian. What I was saying to myself is, every time you meet someone, try to get through that little tiny surface. And then below that, it was just a treasure chest of love and appreciation. And so I was motivated every time. And to do it on a larger and larger scale, i.e. television and radio. So it was my motivator more than anything.
You come here with your $1,000 that
yes.
your father gives to you
yes.
and decide there's a way to use some of that money to have a club night.
That's exactly
start playing
was.
Some hip-hop. I'll let you tell the story.
Hip-hop was the beginning of our economic success in China, and only fitting. I came here, and I was thinking to myself, honestly, it had nothing to do with business at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I was teaching English, Tavis, honestly. I don't know if you realize that, but I was teaching English at that point, and I thought to myself, I love China, but if I don't find some hip-hop here soon, I'm going to have to go home. I will have to leave this place, and I don't want to leave. And being proactive, I said, okay. There's probably also a market for it. So I went to this woman, very kind, and I said, look, your business is not so good on a Thursday. How about I take my net worth, give it to you, rent your club out, and we'll split the proceeds. And she said, it's going to be black music? And I said, well, yes, it is. And she said, okay, let's give it a try. This was a club called Pegasus. In 2 years, it became a Shanghai institution. And that really put me on the road to the TV and the radio shows.
The voiceovers
of Motorola.
Yeah. Motorola, yeah.
Heard my voice, and they said, you know, we can't get a hold of James Earl Jones or Tavis. But they decided that my voice was and what was a good standard.
I look at Chinese, look at it and listen to it and think to myself, as much as I love China myself, I could never learn the language. I could never learn it. I could never, certainly never write it. And moreover, could never read it. So you come here fresh from Duke's campus in North Carolina, never took a class, but I've been around you long enough to now know, because I've seen you interact, that you speak rather fluently. How did you learn that?
Intuitively. The grammar is amazingly simple. It's a sublime language. And I think that the gift of our culture is a sense of tone and that musicality and humility.
你怎么做了？我看到就是这个那个事情，就是在后面。
If you speak Chinese, or if you approach Chinese language with an arrogant sense,
mm-hmm.
I hear it and I can repeat it, you will speak horrible Chinese, and you'll see Chinese people cringe.
Mm-hmm.
If, on the other hand, you truly listen the way a mimic might at first, ultimately the tones become something that's living, and then you can begin to really follow it, and the language becomes more standard. So I'm told now, you know, when I get on the phone or when I talk to people or when I'm on TV, I speak a pretty standard form of Chinese that sounds something approaching the Beijing dialect.
Tell me about how the television show got started, how you got the idea to do that, but answer the question for me in Mandarin, and then tell me what you just said. So how did the TV show get started?
拿到这样句上，那我们可以分享。所以我是同时做主持和跟那个电视台做一些生意。 So what I basically just said in Mandarin was that I already had a radio show called Live It Up Shanghai, and it was pretty popular, and kids seemed to like it. And so Shanghai Media Group approached me, and they said, "You're doing a popular radio show. How would you like to do this TV show?" And I said, "That would be fun." And it became extremely popular, and it was just a blessing.
What do they call you here in China?
They call me Da Long, which literally means big dragon. And it sounds very silly in English, but in Chinese, it's sort of, I mean, I hear that and respond to it the way I'd respond to my name.
Yeah.
It's become my name.
Where is home for Andrew Bowne?
Home is China. Home is my full humanity. And certainly, I think the flower of what I hope and believe is my intellectual potential came to fruition here. I mean, this is where it developed. The welcome that I received here, what I've seen and learned about family and faith, and the ability of those things to make a society flourish, are things that I've learned in China. And I think that it's fair to say that this feels like home to me.
Faith, China. China, faith. Is that oxymoronic? Are there people of faith? Do people in China have a faith, or is it just about hard work and family?
Yeah, that's a good question. One, faith of every different sector, creed, they all exist here. And I think that you'd be surprised. You walk into a church in China, they are jam-packed. And I mean, worship. Mm-hmm. It's shocked me. It's a beautiful thing to see. So don't necessarily believe the hype you hear in some media outlets in the States. But I also think that in China, writ large, there's a more pragmatic faith, and it's a more tangible faith that doesn't really fit nicely into any Western paradigm, but the faith is in family. Mm-hmm. And I know that, I'm not trying to say that in the West we don't have that same faith, but there's something incredibly powerful and visceral about the Chinese sense that their children and what their children are able to do and accomplish in the future is almost like, I don't want to say a god, but it's what is bigger. It's what is bigger than they themselves. But if you ensure, or if they feel as though, whether it's government or social leaders, are allowing them to educate their children and give them an opportunity and to make sure they're safe, that really is the basis of I think, China's faith and its social contract.
How do you process this U.S. push on China around human rights and freedom?
Talk about it. That is indeed a Pandora's box. Uh-huh. I think the simplest way for me to answer it is to say, first, that I honestly believe that China has redefined what social justice means in a way, in a context, in a way that suits them and works for them. And I think the results speak for themselves. Uh-huh. We talk about the ability to rancor, the ability to say, I think this, and you think this, and you think this. Some of that's freedom. And I think arguably it is. But from a different perspective, and I think a uniquely Chinese perspective, 1.3 billion voices all screaming, and people remaining in poverty and people remaining uneducated, that does not equal freedom for them. And I think over the last 30 years, what they have said, and I think more than said, which I think is key for us, they've practiced is a sense that self-sacrifice, the contract that says, you as my government, so long as you continue to make the promise of my children's life better and more fruitful, I will, for the most part, with diligence and effort and a communal sense, because they are a communal society, say, I adhere to that. That indeed is what I want. And so for us to say to them, you should want this, what they're saying is, no, what we want, by and large, is the ability for us to walk forward as a people and to achieve the I think there's no other word other than miraculous. We are well pleased. We are not sycophants. We realize that there are problems here. But we are well pleased with the way this is progressing and playing itself out. And we believe that we are, in fact, living in a society that suits our needs and makes us feel rewarded, free. You asked me several months ago, have you drank the Kool-Aid? Yeah. On some level, I have, in the sense that I believe that I owe audiences here something healthy, something inspirational. And that's what my motto and the message behind what our company does is, with Chinese youth as its focus, we seek nothing less than a redefinition of the 21st century new media space by taking the best artists in the West, the Jay-Z's, the Rihanna's, the Sean Kingston's, and bringing them here and saying, okay, China, you interpret their music any way you want. You create vocality, Chinese instrumentation, whatever you want to do, even change it into Chinese language. Make it your own. I keep on falling in and out of love within you. I never love someone without loving you. What does that say then about the power of music around the world? Well, I think it says something pretty profound about the globalization of African-American youth culture and music. Mm-hmm. Because fundamentally what I'm saying is the Japanese, the Koreans, and the Chinese certainly have taken cues, certainly, and in some cases, just in the Japanese case often, just taken wholesale our music and said, we love this so much. So yeah, I think that it's moved from mimicry to creative indigenization, which is not my term, it's Dr. West, but that's exactly what we're trying to do. And it's been a beautiful thing to watch our culture sort of span the globe. I think it may be the latest and greatest, and if we're not careful, it may be the last, I think, globally important American export. It's not ours anymore. It's not just ours anymore. We've given it to them, and they take it, and it feels right to them, too. Yeah. They don't want those tight pants anymore. They want to let it flow. They want to feel it. Chinese youth is really where I think my heart and my finger is on the pulse right now. And so I think we're staying there and I'm going to try to stay current and try to continue to form a bridge between what I know and love about my true home, which is, of course, America, and my adopted home here.
How often do you get back to the States, number one? And most importantly, what's your daddy saying now?
You know, actually, mom and dad going to kill me. I probably get home for business once every 6-7 weeks. Mm-hmm. Home, Cackalack, mm-hmm. North Carolina home.
North Cackalack.
Not as often as I like. Yeah. And my dad has said to me, you know, what I want from you right now, son, is time. 10 years ago, my father was a 50-something-year-old surgeon. And, great. He's young, vibrant. And now, you know, he's a 60-something-year-old surgeon about to retire, and I realize that the man's my hero. I owe him some time. So as the company continues to grow gangbusters, I'm going to probably take some time to go back home and just really recommune with Pops.
How does Pop feel, though, about the journey? We know how he felt 10 years ago. Mm. He wants to see you more, and I understand that any father would. But how does he feel about your decision made 10 years ago to come to China?
I think my father is proud. He is a quiet man and does not express that pride in a very fluent way. But I know he's proud of me. And I think it was quoted at one point in the Jamaican News and Observer as saying, you know, I think my son made the very, very best of a bad decision. He said that half in jest, but I think that sort of sums up my father's personality.
Staying true to those Jamaican roots.
Indeed, indeed.
Andrew would later join us for a celebration of Dr. West's 58th birthday. In fact, we've been celebrating Pop's birthday from one end of Shanghai to the other, it seemed. From a school in the Minghong suburb, an oasis for the children of migrant workers, to the elite mid-city children's palace. His message of love and respect was always the same.
It was really fascinating for me to be with Dr. West on his 58th birthday. I mean, it really is, you know, at the epicenter of who he is, you know, trying to
love and serve people. And that he would spend his birthday with these migrant workers all day.
There's something on your birthday, brother.
No, this couldn't be a better birthday, brother.
And everywhere we went, you know, they've been singing happy birthday to him in English and in Mandarin. So I think it's been a good day for him, but it was just fascinating to watch him on his birthday do what he does best, which is hang out with everyday people. So it's a beautiful day in that regard. We closed the day. There's a lot more in between, but the other highlight of the day for me was being exposed to the arts and culture in China. I didn't want to come here and not spend some time talking about the arts, talking about culture with people like Andrew Ballin and what he's been able to do vis-a-vis the culture here and bringing the hip-hop culture to China, but also these young people in song and in dance to see what they're doing to move the culture along, to celebrate it in this country. Coming to China has been a great trip. So thanks for hanging out with us. Until next time, keep it. To learn more, visit pbs.org/TavisSmiley.
Saddam, we say Bushan Saddam, but a bam bam with Bushan Saddam. Bushan Saddam, we say Bushan Saddam, but a bam bam with Bushan Saddam. Still, we don't want no war, only love and unity. That's what the people see. They don't want no war, no hell. Because if this war should start, this world would be apart. But less a shadow, there would be no more people at all. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Mass destruction. We can't ruin Mama Nature's plan. The earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof. Yes, them a perpetrate war. Yes, I and I need unity. Yes, them a perpetrate war. Yes, I say we need unity. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam with Bush and Saddam. I wonder if it's the oil and the oil can't spoil. You rather taking people's life, fighting over the oil. Yeah, to the world them won't put an end. They just a world without end. Right you know me friend, you have big one from the drying wood again. Yeah, of the world in his hand. You can change your plan. Before one of your world pass away, heaven and earth bustle. Yes, peace and love we are the way. Peace and love we are the way. Peace and love what we want. Yes, in a Georgia style. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam, Bush and Saddam. Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam. What a bam bam, Bush and Saddam. We don't want no war. We need the unity. We don't want no war. Strictly love and unity. Yes, Bush and Saddam, we say Bush and Saddam.
Por favor, 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 por
you can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
That's all, folks.